Okay, so we'll continue with the first chapter on practices and perspectives. I left off the last with the Buddha praising the recollection of the peace of Nibbana, and that's one of the anusatis, so it can be used as a meditation to be turning attention to peace, which is an important part of the puzzle of in terms of the, I mean, one, it's a practice, but it's also a perspective of where are we going? Where are we going with this? What are we doing? Okay, but we'll continue on. But just as it is important to have an adequate conception of the goal of our practice, it is also important to gain proper knowledge of the path leading to that goal. This section on practices and perspectives provides a framework for developing that conception. So that's basically outlining what these next three chapters were trying to accomplish. In a discourse in the Udana, the Buddha describes the path of practice by comparing it to the continental shelf off the coast of India. This is from Udana 5, Sutta number 5. Just as the ocean shelf has a gradual shelf, a gradual slope, a gradual inclination, with a sharp drop-off only after a long stretch, in the same way this Dhamma and Vinaya has a gradual training, a gradual performance, a gradual progression, with a penetration to gnosis only after a long stretch. The fact that this Dhamma and Vinaya has a gradual training, a gradual performance, a gradual progression, with a penetration to gnosis, only after a long search. This is the first amazing and astounding fact about this Dhamma and Vinaya, that as they see it again and again, has the monks greatly pleased with this Dhamma and Vinaya. So I give a bit of commentary. This image gives a sense of the training required to reach the goal of Nibbana, a gradually deepening practice culminating in a sudden penetration. The foundations of virtue, concentration, and wisdom need to be gradually laid so that the sudden penetration, which is a function of insight, can accomplish its work in truly freeing the heart. In Ajahn Jeff's translation of this, he has a footnote on the ocean has a gradual shelf, gradual slope, gradual inclination, sudden drop-off only after a long stretch. So the Pali here reads, na ayatakeneva pambhato. The commentary insists that this phrase means with no abrupt drop-off. There are three reasons for not accepting the commentary's interpretation here. A, the first is grammatical. The word ayataka means long drawn out, lasting a long time. To interpret ayatakena, the instrumental of a word meaning long drawn out, to mean abrupt, makes little sense. B, the second reason is geographical. The continental shelf off the east coast of India does have a sudden drop-off after a long gradual slope. C, the third reason is doctrinal. As noted in the interpretation of the simile, the shape of the ocean floor corresponds to the course of the practice. If there were no sudden drop-off, there would be no sudden penetration to awakening. However, there are many cases of sudden penetration in the canon, Exhibit A being Bahiya's attainment of arahantship in Udana 1, Sutta number 10. So Bahiya was the arahant who attained the quickest. It was just on his first listening to the Dhamma. And of course there's huge ranges of how long or short people do practice. It's like Sariputta practiced diligently for 2 weeks before penetration. Ratapala is an example where the sutta actually says in no long time after receiving instruction from the Buddha he penetrated the Dhamma in no long time. Then in no long time was then sort of qualified as 14 years. So there's a range. This image comes in a sutta that I thought I would read the whole sutta. It's an interesting sutta because it's a kind of a snapshot of life in the Sangha, life with the Buddha, and then of course the imagery that comes up later in the actual discourse. And it is a and also just the sense of the Dhamma and Vinaya being such inspiration for people, even in the time of the Buddha through till the present day. It's titled Uposatha. Before I start, is there any questions? Good. Okay. I've heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying near Savatthi at the Eastern Monastery, the palace of Megara's mother. And on that occasion, the Blessed One, it being the observance day, was sitting surrounded by the community of monks. Then Venerable Ananda, when the night was far advanced, at the end of the first watch, got up from his seat, arranged his robe over one shoulder, stood facing the Blessed One, paying homage with his hands placed palm to palm over his heart, and said to him, "Lord, the night is far advanced. The first watch has ended. The community of monks has been sitting here long. May the Blessed One recite the Patimokkha to them." When this was said, the Blessed One remained silent. So this comes in the early stage of the development of the Sangha, when the recitation of the Patimokkha, the recitation of the rules of training, were done specifically by the Buddha himself to the community. It's after this that he delegates it to others. Then a second time, when the night was far advanced, at the end of the middle watch, Venerable Ananda got up from his seat, arranged his robe over one shoulder, stood facing the Blessed One, paying homage with his hands placed palm to palm over his heart, and said to him, "Lord, the night is far advanced. The second watch has ended. The community of monks has been sitting here long. May the Blessed One recite the Patimokkha to them." When this was said, the Blessed One remained silent. Then a third time, when the night was far advanced, at the end of the last watch, as dawn was approaching, and as the face of the night was beaming, Venerable Ananda got up from his seat, arranged his robe over one shoulder, stood facing the Blessed One, paying homage with his hands placed palm to palm over his heart, and said to him, "Lord, the night is far advanced. The last watch has ended. Dawn is approaching, and the face of the night is beaming. The community of monks has been sitting here long. May the Blessed One recite the Patimokkha to the community of monks." Ananda, the gathering isn't pure. Then the thought occurred to Venerable Mahamoggallana, in reference to which individual did the Blessed One just now say, "Ananda, the gathering isn't pure"? So he directed his mind, encompassing with his awareness the awareness of the entire community of monks. He saw that individual, unprincipled, evil, unclean, and suspect in his undertakings, hidden in his actions, not a contemplative though claiming to be one, not leading the holy life though claiming to do so, inwardly rotten, oozing with desire, filthy by nature, sitting in the midst of the community of monks. On seeing him, he got up, went over to that individual, and on reaching him, said, "Get up, friend. You have been seen by the Blessed One. You have no affiliation with the community of monks." Then the individual remained silent. A second time, a third time, Venerable Mahamoggallana said, "Get up, friend. You have been seen by the Blessed One. You have no affiliation with the community of monks." And for a third time, the individual remained silent. Then Venerable Mahamoggallana, grabbing that individual by the arm, having expelled him through the outside door of the porch and locking the bolt, approached the Blessed One and on arrival said, "I have expelled that individual, Lord. The gathering is now pure. Let the Blessed One recite the Patimokkha to the community of monks." Isn't it amazing, Moggallana, isn't it astounding how that worthless man waited until he was grabbed by the arm? Then the Blessed One addressed the monks, "From now on I will no longer perform the observance or recite the Patimokkha. From now on you alone, monks, will perform the observance and recite the Patimokkha. It is impossible, it cannot happen, that a Tathagata would perform the observance or recite the Patimokkha with an impure gathering." Monks, there are these eight amazing and astounding qualities of the ocean, because of which, as they see them again and again, the Asuras, take great joy in the ocean. So asuras are another class of being. They're kind of powerful, but not quite human either. One, the ocean has a gradual shelf, a gradual slope, a gradual inclination, with a sudden drop-off only after a long stretch. The fact that the ocean has a gradual shelf, a gradual slope, a gradual inclination with a sudden drop-off only after a long stretch. This is the first amazing and astounding quality of the ocean, because of which, as they see it again and again, the asuras take great joy in the ocean. And furthermore, the ocean is stable and does not overstep its tide line. This is the second amazing and astounding quality of the ocean, because of which, as they see it again and again, the asuras take great joy in the ocean. 3. And furthermore, the ocean does not tolerate a dead body. Any dead body in the ocean gets quickly washed to the shore and thrown up on dry land. This is the third amazing and astounding quality of the ocean, because of which, as they see it again and again, the asuras take great joy in the ocean. To me, it's also of interest. The Buddha is using the simile of the ocean. And there's other images where, like, the Buddha talks about the rigging on ships getting rotten when the boats are left by the seashore. And Savatthi is a long way from the ocean. I don't know how far, but it's got to be over 500 miles. Not close, but the Buddha is speaking of this in firsthand knowledge of that. 4. I just couldn't resist. And furthermore, whatever great rivers there are, such as the Ganges, the Yamuna, Achiravati, the Sarabu, the Mahi, on reaching the ocean, give up their former names and are classed simply as ocean. This is the fourth amazing and astounding quality of the ocean, because of which, as they see it again and again, the asuras take great joy in the ocean. 5. And furthermore, though the rivers of the world pour into the ocean and rains fall from the sky, no swelling or diminishing in the ocean for that reason can be discerned. This is the fifth amazing and astounding quality of the ocean, because of which, as they see it again and again, the asuras take great joy in the ocean. 6. And furthermore, the ocean has a single taste, that of salt. This is the sixth amazing and astounding quality of the ocean, because of which, as they see it again and again, the asuras take great joy in the ocean. 7. And furthermore, the ocean has these many treasures of various kinds: pearls, sapphires, lapis lazuli, shells, quartz, coral, silver, gold, rubies, and cat's eyes. This is the seventh amazing and astounding quality of the ocean, because of which, as they see it again and again, the asuras take great joy in the ocean. 8. And furthermore, the ocean is the abode of such mighty beings as these: whales, whale-eaters, and whale-eater-eaters, asuras, nagas, and gandhavas. There are in the ocean beings 100 leagues long, 200, 300, 400, 500 leagues long. The fact that the ocean is the abode of such mighty beings as these: whales, whale-eaters, and whale-eater-eaters, asuras, nagas, and gandhavas, and there are in the ocean beings 100 leagues long, 200, 300, 400, 500 leagues long. This is the eighth amazing and astounding quality of the ocean, because of which, as they see it again and again, the asuras take great joy in the ocean. These are the eight amazing and astounding qualities of the ocean, because of which, as they see them again and again, the asuras take great joy in the ocean. In the same way, monks, there are eight amazing and astounding qualities of this Dhamma and Vinaya, because of which, as they see them again and again, the monks take great joy in this Dhamma and Vinaya. Which 8? 1. Just as the ocean has a gradual shelf, a gradual slope, a gradual inclination, with a sudden drop-off only after a long stretch, in the same way this Dhamma and Vinaya has a gradual training, a gradual performance, a gradual practice, with a penetration to gnosis only after a long stretch. The fact that this Dhamma and Vinaya has a gradual training, a gradual performance, a gradual practice, with a penetration to gnosis only after a long stretch, this is the first amazing and astounding quality of this Dhamma and Vinaya, because of which, as they see it again and again, the monks take great joy in this Dhamma and Vinaya. 2. And furthermore, just as the ocean is stable and does not overstep its tide line, in the same way, my disciples do not, even for the sake of their lives, overstep the training rules I have formulated for them. This is the second amazing and astounding quality of this Dhamma and Vinaya, because of which, as they see it again and again, the monks take great joy in this Dhamma and Vinaya. 3. And furthermore, just as the ocean does not tolerate a dead body, any dead body in the ocean gets quickly washed to the shore and thrown up on dry land, in the same way, if an individual is unprincipled, evil, unclean, and suspect in his undertakings, hidden in his actions, not a contemplative though claiming to be one, not leading the holy life though claiming to do so, inwardly rotten, oozing with desire, filthy by nature, the community has no affiliation with him. Having quickly gathered together, they suspend him from the community. Even though he may be sitting in the midst of the community of monks, he is far from the community, and the community far from him. This is the third amazing and astounding quality of this Dhamma and Vinaya, because of which, as they see it again and again, the monks take great joy in this Dhamma and Vinaya. 4. And furthermore, just as whatever great rivers there are, such as the Ganges, the Yamuna, the Achiravati, the Sarabhu, the Mahi, on reaching the ocean give up their former names and are classed simply as ocean, in the same way, when members of the four castes, noble warriors, Brahmins, merchants, and workers, go forth from home to the homeless life in this Dhamma and Vinaya declared by the Tathagata, they give up their former names and clans and are classed simply as contemplatives, sons of the Sakyan. This is the fourth amazing and astounding quality of this Dhamma and Vinaya, because of which, as they see it again and again, the monks take great joy in this Dhamma and Vinaya. 5. And furthermore, just as the rivers of the world pour into the ocean, and rains fall from the sky, but no swelling or diminishing in the ocean for that reason can be discerned. In the same way, although many monks are totally unbound in this property of unbinding, it's this property of Nibbana, with no fuel remaining, no swelling or diminishing in the property of Nibbana for that reason can be discerned. This is the fifth amazing and astounding quality of this Dhamma and Vinaya, because of which, as they see it again and again, the monks take great joy in this Dhamma and Vinaya. 6. And furthermore, just as the ocean has a single taste, that of salt, in the same way this Dhamma and Vinaya has a single taste, that of release. This is the sixth amazing and astounding quality of this Dhamma and Vinaya, because of which, as they see it again and again, the monks take great joy in this Dhamma and Vinaya. 7. And furthermore, just as the ocean has these many treasures of various kinds, pearls, sapphires, lapis lazuli, shells, quartz, coral, silver, gold, rubies, and cat's eyes, in the same way, this Dhamma and Vinaya has these many treasures of various kinds, the four establishings of mindfulness, the four right exertions, the four bases of power, the five faculties, the five strengths, the seven factors for awakening, the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the seventh amazing and astounding quality of this Dhamma and Vinaya, because of which, as they see it again and again, the monks take great joy in this Dhamma and Vinaya. 8. And furthermore, just as the ocean is the abode of such mighty beings as these, whales, whale-eaters, and whale-eater-eaters, asuras, nagas, and gandhavas, and there are in the ocean beings 100 leagues long, 200, 300, 400, 500 leagues long, in the same way, this Dhamma and Vinaya is the abode of such mighty beings as these, stream winners and those practicing to realize the fruit of stream entry, once returners and those practicing to realize the fruit of once returning, non-returners and those practicing to realize the fruit of non-returning, arahants and those practicing for arahantship. The fact that this Dhamma and Vinaya is the abode of such mighty beings as these, stream winners and those practicing to realize the fruit of stream entry, once returners and those practicing to realize the fruit of once returning, non-returners and those practicing to realize the fruit of non-returning, arahants and those practicing for arahantship. This is the eighth amazing and astounding quality of this Dhamma and Vinaya, because of which, as they see it again and again, the monks take great joy in this Dhamma and Vinaya. These are the eight amazing and astounding qualities of this Dhamma and Vinaya, because of which, as they see them again and again, the monks take great joy in this Dhamma and Vinaya. Then, on realizing the significance of that, the Blessed One on that occasion exclaimed, Rain soddens what's covered and doesn't sodden what's open. So open up what's covered up, so that it won't get sodden by the rain. Any comments, queries? And to me, it's just one of these beautiful suttas describing the Dhamma Vinaya and its various qualities. Also, just that fact that the Buddha had to contend with misbehaving monks and how to work with it, how to deal with it. You'd think people would have thought they've got the opportunity to practice with the Lord Buddha himself, and they miss that opportunity. Okay, so we'll continue on. This image of gradual training but sudden penetration will provide the framework for the discussion in this chapter and the chapters to follow. That is the paradigm that I'm working with in this, because I say there's three chapters on practices and perspectives. It is important to keep both sides of this perspective in mind so that, as seekers, we can avoid the problems that can come from focusing on one side to the exclusion of the other. For instance, believing that we can expect results only after long, long practice of many lifetimes, which can easily put us in the discouraging position of pursuing a goal that increasingly recedes into the distance. Or we may believe that we are already perfectly enlightened, that effort entangles us needlessly, and that the thing to do is just be free, which leaves us doing nothing much at all, and yet still mired in our entanglements. These are extreme positions, but they highlight the extent to which the path needs to be clearly understood in order to train most effectively. The dual nature of the path, both sudden and gradual, is dictated by the nature of the goal. Nibbana, like all of the Dhamma, is, quote, directly visible, immediate, to be personally experienced by the wise. So that when we, morning chanting, evening chanting, recite the qualities of the Dhamma, that is part of the classic or traditional description of the Dhamma. And then this is a quote from a Sutta Anguttara 3, Sutta number 55. Once the Brahman Janusoni approached the Blessed One and spoke to him thus, "It is said, Master Gotama, Nibbana is directly visible. In what way, Master Gotama, is Nibbana directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, worthy of application, to be personally experienced by the wise? When, Brahman, a person is impassioned with lust, or depraved through hatred, or bewildered through delusion, overwhelmed and infatuated by delusion, then he plans for his own harm, for the harm of others, for the harm of both, and he experiences in his mind suffering and grief. But when lust, hatred, and delusion have been abandoned, he neither plans for his own harm, nor for the harm of others, nor for the harm of both, and he does not experience in his mind suffering and grief. In this way, Brahman, is Nibbana directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, worthy of application, to be personally experienced by the wise. So what the Buddha is saying is coming back to the experiential measuring stick of the Dhamma, rather than looking at some kind of philosophical ideal. It's sort of, what's the result of when Nibbana is directly visible? How do I experience it? Nibbana being the ending of suffering, then when one does things, when there is greed, hatred, delusion, inevitably it creates suffering for oneself, suffering for others, suffering for both. And of course the opposite is true. When one is able to free the heart from whatever greed, hatred, delusion there is, there's two main ways that the Buddha defines Nibbana or expresses Nibbana. Nibbana as ending of suffering, Nibbana as the ending of greed, hatred, delusion. Those are the two main ways that the Buddha describes or points to Nibbana. Okay, any questions?
Yeah. In your understanding, Ajahn, would you say ending of greed, hatred, and delusion, would you say it's eradicated, not arising anymore?
In the word for cessation, like Nirodha, there is that sort of paradigm. So is it absolutely cut off or does it not arise? And because something is seen clearly, and this is a definition of the word Nirodha, normally it's translated as cessation or cessation ending, but also another valid translation of Nirodha is non-arising. When something doesn't arise, it doesn't exist. And if something is seen so clearly as being painful or complicated or difficult or subject to suffering and doesn't arise, it's no longer manifesting, no longer appearing.
Because we hear sometimes it's arising, but the person is not grasping it.
Yeah, well, that's why I say the sense of there might be an inclination. I mean, something is seen so clearly. I mean, if it's arising and one's just sort of holding it at bay, that's different than the mind is so clear and seeing. Because there are residual. The Buddha was the only person to completely free the mind from any residual personality character traits, whereas by definition an arhant is free from greed, hatred, delusion, but there's still going to be residual patterns that are manifesting but no longer playable or they don't get any traction. Yeah.
That's similar to, say, both Ajahn Chah's and Ajahn Dhun's declarations of, yes, I have a lot of anger, but I don't pick it up, I don't use it.
Yes, that's a good, the famous story of Ajahn Chah having a palm reader coming, and he was so curious, he wanted to read Ajahn Chah's palms. And so finally, Ajahn Chah sort of let him, and then he's looking, and he's... And it's probably various things get embedded. And he looks and looking at them. So, Lumpa, by the lines in your hand, you have a lot of anger. And Ajahn Chah, yes, but I don't use it. But there's also one time I remember we were on a train journey, and Lumpa V was looking at Lumpa's hands. I can't remember. He was massaging his hands or doing something. We're all sitting together. It was like we're on third-class rail carriage going from Ubon to Bangkok on a day trip. And Lumpa V says, Lumpa, I heard somebody say that when somebody is purified, the lines on their palms of their hands are really clear. And he said, but yours, there seems to be lines going everywhere. And Lumpa sort of smiled and he says, well, that means I've had lots of suffering. And he said, because without that suffering, I wouldn't be able to teach you all this. I wouldn't have the wisdom that I have. It was very sweet. Okay. Thus, our own direct experience is where we can recognize whether or not we are creating suffering by following lust, hatred, and delusion. We can also experience the absence of suffering and the peace that ensues when we abandon those qualities. This direct perception of the results that come from putting the teachings into practice is what has inspired the followers of the Buddha to continue to practice and train in accordance with his teaching. Although Nibbana is immediate, the number of people who have actually seen it is infinitesimal. This is because Nibbana is extremely subtle, so subtle that the Buddha, after first awakening, grew discouraged at the prospect of teaching it. This is from Majjhima 26. It's actually from the same sutta that I read the other day, the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Noble Search. I considered, this Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. But this generation delights in adhesion, takes delight in adhesion, rejoices in adhesion. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth, namely specific conditionality, dependent origination. And it is hard to see this truth, namely the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all attachments, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, Nibbana. If I were to teach the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me. Fortunately for us, the Buddha abandoned his hesitation and devoted himself to 45 years of tireless service for the benefit of those who wish to practice and realize the fruits of his teachings. Nevertheless, the subtlety of the goal is what requires a gradual path of practice in which one's powers of concentration, mindfulness, and discernment become steadily heightened to the point where they lead to a direct realization of the goal. This means that an important part of the path will include practices that enable us to increase the subtlety of our powers of perception and will direct our search for the peace of Nibbana to the point where searching is no longer necessary. And the next quote is from the Itiwuttaka, 54 and 55. Bhikkhus, there are these three kinds of search. What three? The search for sensual gratification, the search for being, the search for a holy life. These are the three. A disciple of the Buddha, concentrated, clearly comprehending, and mindful, knows searches and the origin of searches, where they cease and the path that leads to their full destruction. With the destruction of searches, a bhikkhu, without longing, has attained Nibbana. Bhikkhus, there are these three kinds of search: sensual search, the search for being, the search for a holy life, of one who takes his stand upon a view and holds it tightly as the truth. These are heapings of defilements. For a bhikkhu wholly dispassionate and freed by the destruction of craving, searches have been relinquished and uprooted the standpoint of views. With the destruction of searches, a bhikkhu is free from desire and doubt. So the Buddha's pointing to the natural inclination in human life that we're looking for something to gratify or satisfy us. And the search for sensual gratification is search for displeasure and comfort and convenience. And search for being is much more around the sense of propping up a sense of self-importance, self-ease, self-comfort, self-gratification. And then the search for a holy life, the search for true meaning and true understanding. This is Brahmacharya, a life of purity. the sensual search for being, search for holy life, who take a stand upon a view, because even the search for a holy life, if you take your stand upon a view, a ditti, a fixed view, you're going to trip yourself up as well. So it's not as if just because you have conceived of this fact, there is a path of purity somewhere, doesn't exempt one from the problems that can arise through that. So one needs to be ready to relinquish any aspect of the mind entangled in its searches, in its cravings. Okay. Any questions? Okay, the Buddha taught numerous gradual practices that lead to the awakening that puts an end to searching. An entire section in the Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 43, the connected discourses on the unconditioned, lays out many such practices, beginning with 1, mindfulness directed to the body, 2, serenity and insight, 3, concentration with thought and examination, concentration without thought, with examination only, concentration without thought and examination, 4, the emptiness concentration, the signless concentration, the undirected concentration, sunyata samadhi, animitta samadhi, apanahitta samadhi, 5, 4 foundations of mindfulness, 6, 4 right strivings, 7, 4 bases for spiritual power, 8, 5 spiritual faculties, 9, 5 powers, 10, 7 factors of enlightenment, and 11, the Eightfold Path. These methods form the foundation of practice in the Theravada tradition. An accountant, Ganaka Moggallana, asked the Buddha if there is a gradual training in the Buddha's teaching similar to that of an accountant. And that's the Ganaka Moggallana Sutta. He actually gives a description of how they train people to count and take the 1 1s and the 2 2s, and it's a very kind of sweet. This is how we train accountants. Is there a similar training for a spiritual or religious training? And that's Majjhima 107. It is possible, Brahman, to describe gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress in this Dhamma and discipline, just as, Brahman, when a clever horse trainer obtains a fine thoroughbred colt, he first makes him get used to wearing the bit, and afterwards trains him further. So when the Tathagata obtains a person to be tamed, he first disciplines him thus. And then the Buddha gives a description of training in virtue, sense restraint, moderation in eating, devotion to wakefulness, freeing the mind of the 5 hindrances, and then meditations culminating in the 4 jhanas. This is my instruction, Brahman, to those bhikkhus who are in the higher training, whose minds have not yet attained the goal, who abide aspiring to the supreme security from bondage. But these things conduce both to a pleasant abiding here and now and to mindfulness and full awareness for those bhikkhus who are arhants with taints destroyed, who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and are completely liberated through final knowledge. So what the Buddha is saying is that all these different practices are part of a path of training, path of practice, culminating in the goal, but also even for those who have realized the fruits of the practice, who have realized Nibbana, all of these practices are also a source of a pleasant abiding here and now and to mindfulness and full awareness in the present moment. There's no drawback. There's no downside to it. The purpose of these ways of practice is to induce an inclining toward Nibbana, as expressed in the wanderer Vajragotha's praises for the Buddha and his followers. So this is a quote from Majjhima 73, which is in the, that's the Mahavajragotha Sutta, Just as the river Ganges inclines towards the sea, slopes towards the sea, flows towards the sea, and extends all the way to the sea, so too Master Gotama's assembly with its homeless ones and its householders inclines towards Nibbana, slopes towards Nibbana, flows towards Nibbana, and extends all the way to Nibbana. And at the end of the sutta, Vajragotha is a wanderer in the time of the Buddha, lots and lots of questions. And there are several discourses that are given to Vajragotha. I mean, one of the famous ones, the Agni Vajragotha Sutta, where the Buddha uses the simile of fire going out to describe the nature of Nibbana. So yeah, he was a doubter. But in the Mahavajragotha Sutta, he actually goes forth and realizes awakening. And then in that same sutta, the Buddha talks of the many, many disciples, both the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen, laywomen, who have realized all the different fruits of the path. So it's quite a powerful sutta with the Buddha saying, not just one or two, but many, many, many have realized the fruits of the path. Any questions? Yes.
Yeah, I've got a question about devotion to wakefulness. There's almost a sort of suggestion that just 4 hours of sleep is enough. Now, I know some people can cope with that, but I've always struggled with not getting much sleep. You know, it kind of feels like torture if I force myself to stay awake.
Yes, and it actually is a well-known torture.
Would you encourage this for the likes of myself?
People are different constitutions, and so that you have to be practical in terms of your own capability and your own inclination, you know, just a natural inclination. Some things you can, you know, obviously we can train and get past. Some things are a limitation. Like Ajahn Chah really did not like fasting. But, you know, staying up all night was not at all a problem. Or staying up for many nights. He just said, just drop into samadhi now and again and refresh oneself. So it's just different. So I think you just have to be honest with yourself. You have to sort of experiment and see, you know, how much of this. Okay, this is a standard that the Buddha lays down or suggests. You know, how well does that fit with me? Or how can I accomplish that? So that different people have different capacities. And so I just be honest with it and work with, some people. Like, I've been going to see a Tibetan doctor, 20 years now. And it still drives her nuts that I don't sleep enough. By her standard, I just don't sleep enough. And
8 hours being what she...
Yeah, she's like 7 or 8 hours. That's just so beyond my capacity. I didn't really have much problem 4 hours. Early days of being a monk, I would sit and then walk until at Wat Nanachan, there's a train that would go past Bung Wai Station about 10 after 11. And then I would usually do walking meditation until I heard that train go by. And then I would go in to go to sleep. And then the bell rang at 3 o'clock in the morning. So it was just a routine that I had. It was enough. As I get older, that's not... I need more sleep. So it's just different bodies, different times. Different bodies need different. You just have to, you know, similar with the amounts of food. You know, some people just need more food. And they still don't gain any weight. It just really bugs me. I can't imagine how it works. I look at food and I gain weight.
You're torture.
Yeah. These basic things, there's such a range. Yeah, you have to be very practical about it.
I had heard that there was one winter retreat where Ajahn Chah had the community practice midnight vigil every night of the retreat. Were you there at that time?
I was not there. That was early days of Wat Pa Phong. Mm. It was during the Pansa.
Ah, Pansa.
Yeah, keeping the vigil every night. And then the last, I can't think it was the last month. So it was 3 months of doing sitter's practice every night. And then the last month, he forbade people from getting up and moving. You go in the evening, you do your evening chanting, begin the meditation, and then that's it. Yeah. You sit for the rest of the time. I wouldn't have survived. Oh, I think that was just before he went to Wat Pa Phong.
What do you mean before he went?
He was in the adjoining province, and he was just beginning to teach. Okay. And so he's all fired up. Ajahn Chah fired up, that's pretty scary. Okay. That's it for the evening, 7 o'clock.